Session number 8263, Reel 3.
Captain Eyes Ratliff, Reel 3. I think you were saying that your convoy was attacked.
I think there were four or five Italian planes flying, you know, fairly high. So that any accurate bombing, you know, would be impossible. Anyway, they had the destroyers escort, and they let loose into these things and drove them off, but not before they had dropped some of their bombs. And one of the boats was hit aft, and there was smoke pouring out of it and what have you. And one of the other boats behind it came up with a hose, a fire hose, and extinguished the fire, and that was the lot.
So your ship didn't sink?
No, thankfully.
Was that the only attack on you?
That was the only air attack, yeah.
Where did that take place? Was that in mid-ocean?
Yes, in the Indian Ocean. I don't think it could have been very far off, Somaliland area, you know, because the Italians were still operating over there until ejected.
And you landed at Port Sudan. What was your first impression of Sudan?
I wasn't really surprised at what I saw, but at the same time, I found it rather strange with these dock hands, the fuzzy wuzzies. Oh, they looked like fuzzy wuzzies to me anyway. With great bushy, curly hair with lumps of camel fat stuck all over the place, stinking of high heaven. And they wouldn't bother to come on board like a normal docker would. You know, they were clambering around the place like a lot of monkeys. Anyway, looking out from the boat out to the area, the great expanse of sort of whitish sand, terrific glare coming off it, and the other Sudanese walking around in their yashmak or whatever they are, you know, the white garments. And a lot of cars and things, which I didn't expect really in a place like that, because if anyone looks at a map, you know, Port Sudan isn't a, you know, world-class port, and as a port, it isn't very large, and there weren't many largish buildings there, but, you know, it seemed more strange than anything else.
What happened to you then once you'd unloaded?
The vehicles and guns were, as I say, they came in on different boats, so there was only us with our kit to disembark, and we marched down to the railway siding and got on a train there, which was very uncomfortable, on solid wooden seats, and you know, and then the intense heat. There were no fans in the compartments or carriages. And we just went, took off from there, and went to Haya, which is a rail junction. It's from at Haya where the rail split. One line goes to Kassala, which was inoperative then because the Italians were in Kassala. The other one, Atbara, Khartoum. But we got off, disembarked, detrained at Haya, and marched to the area where we were going to camp in a most inhospitable patch. It was completely grassless, treeless, and just sort of jagged rocks and rocks everywhere and sand everywhere. The one had the 160-pounder tent, but you had to find a spot which would take it. You know, it was so limited in flat sand. And if one went, you know, trying to knock 10 pegs in, you see, 2-3 inches down, and you were in solid rock. So you had to fish around and see, find a spot in which you could pitch your tent. Activity from then on was normal parades. And the first few days was going down to unload equipment and stores and what have you from the train. And it came up on 3 tonners and 1,500 weights. Well, when all that was done, we and resumed training. Of course, it was only training to sort of speed up what we all, I mean, there's no room for improvement really, because they were all professional soldiers. And, but I suppose it was get used to deploying and bringing guns into action and sand and difficult ground surfaces or things.
Did you do any live firing while you were there?
No, not at all. I think the emphasis was on the conservation of ammunition for when it was really needed.
How far from the junction was your camp?
Four, 5 miles, might have been a little more. There's no road to it, it's just a rough track. Again, very, very difficult to negotiate with a heavily laden vehicle, because you're, you know, riding over bits of rock and things.
Yeah. And was there anyone else there apart from yourselves?
No, there's just the whole battery, the first fifth.
How long were you at that camp then?
I can't remember exactly, but I should imagine about 6 weeks.
Mm. And was there anything to do when you weren't actually working?
If one felt inclined to do it, one could go down to Haya itself. It's maybe a small Sudanese village. And meander about in the bazaar there. And the Sudanese people are awfully nice and hospitable. Great black faces of theirs grinning and with their teeth like piano keys, and, you know, really pleased to see us and so on. And some of them, often I, when I, if I went down, a couple of friends of mine are going to have a coffee, and they didn't want you to pay for it. The coffee was incidentally was some very, very powerful stuff and in very small little cups. But the tea was the same, and they really concentrated stuff. But they were so pleased and that we were there. And I don't mean in that sense that they were pleased that we were there to defend them, but they were pleased with us, you know, as persons, which is quite a different thing. You know, gratitude and friendship, two different things. You see.
What was the food like while you were in this camp?
As it was for the next more or less a year, it was either fried bully or fried bacon for breakfast with biscuits, which are fairly unpalatable really. At lunch, or the midday meal, was cold bully and biscuits, and at night it was again bully or sometimes some weird McConaughey's type stew, but very, very seldom. Mainly it was bully stew, and again biscuits and tea with each of these meals.
Were you able to buy any food locally in the bazaar?
No, there was nothing really there to buy. You could buy cigarettes and occasionally some fruit or the other, but not in any quantity. And one didn't go down all that often anyhow, you know. And as there was no industry or plantations or any means, we were rather loath to take anything from them. We'd rather leave the population to have what was in their bazaars.
Did you get any drink while you were?
None whatsoever. That was absolutely out of the question. There was a naffy tent set up there, a bulk issue place, units to get their own stuff. But they only, I think there was a very tight ration on it. It was spirit for the, and could have easily been bottled beer for the officers' messes. But when, as far as the soldiery were concerned, there was no liquor of any description.
Now, you say you were just doing ordinary gunner training. So were you doing the same sort of thing as you would have been doing in India?
Oh, yes, yes. It's driving out to anywhere where they're elected to do a deployment of the guns. And the gun position would already be selected, and it's a question of, you know, halt, action rear, action right, action left, or whatever. And we go through this series of fire orders, and then up stakes, and prepare to move, and then go somewhere else and do the same thing. It was only to, you know, to get things really, you know, on the top line.
When you were, supposing you were moving along, towards an exercise position, and you were given the order to deploy and open fire. Roughly, how long would it take before you had actually?
Well, from the time of getting the order to the time of, a couple of minutes. But that's getting the limber into position and getting the ammunition. Door down, the gun laid, and if there was no visible aiming point, you know, like a hill or anything like that, and aiming posts had to be put out. You see, all this would take a little bit of time, but mainly there was always something there that one could lay on. So, you know, very, very quick indeed.
Was it mainly direct fire that you were?
No, it's always indirect.
Always indirect.
No. Direct fire would have come had we had armour careering across our front or coming at us, but there wasn't any of this. And I don't think anyway with the 18-pounder it would have been very effective.
Were there any special local conditions that affected the gun drill or the use of the guns at all?
None. No. It's just, it's only the terrain, that was all. But then we overcame that quite happily. There was nothing else to worry anyone, like, you know, going down steep cliffs and things like that. It was all so flat and inhospitable, it just wasn't true.
Was just a plain littered with rocks.
Yeah.
Now you were at this camp for 6 weeks or so, presumably getting acclimatised and sorted out. What happened to you after that?
Well, at the end of that, B Troop went back down the line to a base camp, Gibeet, I don't know quite how to pronounce it. And there was a BMH down there. We went trained and went to Attborough. It's just a few hours' journey from there. Detrained at Attborough, and the vehicles came off the flat and so on. And then we got the convoy ready, and then from Attborough we headed for this place I mentioned earlier, Ghaz Rajiv, the one by the Attborough River, which was some 150 miles away. And that was done through across desert, just desert tracks, some on very, very firm, hard surfaces, others of very, very soft, sinky sand, some grassland, it's all parched, by the way, some scrub and some trees, but they all ran in belts. And that night we got to this place by the river, which was absolute paradise. It was a beautiful shade, it was cool, the river running just a few yards away, and the excellent cover, so we didn't have to worry about camouflaging the vehicles. The vehicles and guns could just drive under these fairly big trees. And the only tentage that was put up was for the officers. And we all slept, some in and the others around the vehicles and in the guns. And we functioned much the same as we'd done anywhere else, except the fact that we weren't living in buildings. And we had our morning reveille, roll call, gun drill, signalling drill, or whatever. Again, we went out and did tactical deployments. And one of the things that hadn't happened to us before was that we went out to a couple of places where we buried a lot of ammunition, particularly this half-charged stuff, and in other places the 4 gallon, hundreds of gallons of the of petrol, the 4 gallon tin things, in rather large sort of trenches, and then just covered them over with sand and made them look as though nothing had ever been disturbed. They were marked, and people knew on the map where they were, should they be required. And the whole basis of this was for, in case we had to do a quick evacuation.
Were these dumps behind the river then, back?
Not very far from where we were camped. I'd say a couple of miles away from where we were, no more. Because it was not very far from Castler, and if there was a push coming, it would have come from Castler if the Italian decided to attack. But nothing happened, and all this stuff was just left there until a later date when it was needed.
What was the river like? How wide was it?
About 30 yards wide, fairly deep, fairly fast flowing. Very, very nice. There was no sort of debris floating down the thing, apart from, leaves. But although it was fast flowing, there weren't any tree trunks and things like that going down. And I can't remember seeing any crocodiles there, because we used to go and swim in it for good recreation.
Had you got dug gun pits?
No, we hadn't dug any gun pits there. But we did have the slit trenches, just in case. There were no gun pits, because there wouldn't have been... We wouldn't have deployed there anyway. If we were going to deploy, we would have, you know, got out into more open ground, because they're down by the river, fairly low compared to the normal level of the terrain.
And how wide was this belt of trees in which you were?
Oh, that was the probably about 60 yards. So.
Were there any other friendly troops in the area?
Not as one would call sort of resident troops. The ones we had that came up and camped alongside us for short periods was the Cypriot RASC people. We didn't get on any too well with them. It was the soldiery didn't like the way that they behaved. They were sort of animal-like in a way. You know, there were some beautiful birds around there, you know, all beautiful colours. And whether it be a crow or a hawk or anything else, I mean, these chaps just blasted it, and it was just put in the stew pot, and we couldn't understand this, because, I mean, if we could survive on what we were getting, they were getting the same, surely they could survive. And the other thing that they did was running parallel to this line of trees, there was a very coarse scrub stuff, which was about 18 inches or 2 foot high, you know, scraggy. And the local Sudanese from the village, which was some 3 or 4 miles away, used to come and graze their sheep around there. And these Sudanese go and lie down in the, not Sudanese, these Cypriots, go and lie down there with their jackknives or daggers or whatever. And the sheep would come by, you see, they merely catch all, it would slit its throat and, you know, take it away. But we didn't go along with this kind of thing. And, of course, the other thing was that when they got stuck in the sand, and they had Bedford trucks, instead of getting their sand tracks out, they would just rev and rev and rev until they were right down to their axles, you see. And if some of our people would go along and say, well, look, you know, you're being a BF boy, why don't you get out and dig your vehicle out? And they'd throw their arms up in the air and say, oh, England plenty, England plenty, you see. So they didn't care a damn, you know, how many lives had been lost bringing this transport over to the Sudan. I mean, to them, England was a bottomless pit, you know. And it's, you know, things like this that upset us, and we didn't like them. We didn't get on with them at all. But the Sudanese, you know, now and again you'd get a squadron of armoured cars. They would come along and they'd sit around the fire with us at night and chat and laugh and joke and, you know, really enjoy the thing, you know. That was great.
Was there any trouble between you and the Cypriots then?
No, there's no trouble as such. It was just a verbal disagreement and on their business with their, you know, running their vehicles into the ground, which we didn't like. But it never came to blows.
So it's just bad feeling, really.
Mm-hmm. Resentment and contempt. I know they were fighting with us or doing something towards the fighting and supply, but, I mean, what they were doing was quite unnecessary and unpleasant.
So how long were you on the Atbara then, in that camp?
September, end of October. Again, about 6 weeks. Mm. Yeah.
And then when did you move to next?
From there, it was rather a strange set of circumstances. Our troop commander, his name is John Gordon, he's captain. Very fine man, total soldier. He had some connection with Gordon of Khartoum. I don't quite know exactly what it was, but anyway. And he got permission for us to go to Kassler and have pop a few rounds off. So now it would be, I think, on the 31st of October of 1940. We didn't know anything about what was going on. You know, sitting around the campfire and chatting and smoking and enjoying each other's company. When the numbers one came round to the detachments and said, right, prepare to move. So we all had to pack up all our gear, ready to move, you know, the very early hours of the morning. And word got round, you know, that we were going to go to Kassler. So, anyway, the hour came and we moved off. And late the following afternoon, we drove into a copse with some fairly, fairly large trees and had a meal and so on. And then that night, we moved into position, which has already been reconnoitred and selected, at about, I should say, 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and got the guns into action and proceeded to dig slit trenches and so on.
But you say get them into action.
Do you mean they were ready to fire.
Into firing position.
Yeah, oh yes. Yeah. Mm. And at 7 o'clock in the morning, we got the thing to start firing, which we did. And about 5 minutes time, we weren't very far from Kassler. In fact, we could hear the Italian guns firing, and then we'd wait, you know, and then you'd hear the whistle and the shells coming over, you know, so we're sitting in these trenches as though we were in rowing boats, you know, so, you know. There was this intense barrage. I don't know, probably anything from 50 to 100 guns letting loose at us, because from what we gleaned later, the castle had been fortified like a hornet's nest. This barrage continued till 10:30. By this time it was very, very hot indeed. And this stuff for 3.5 hours, you know, was just coming over on a search and sweep basis. And somehow they just managed to, you know, skirt us all the way, front, rear, left, right. And there wasn't a single vehicle scratched or a person wounded.